Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Psalms chapter 15, short psalm, verses 1 through 5, the title of which is A Psalm of David. Very simple title. This is the 14th straight psalm, starting from Psalms 2, in which the title or other scriptures tell us that David was the author. So we start now in Psalms 15:1. Before I start, though, let me give you a title. We're going to call this psalm, Who Shall Dwell on Your Holy Hill? So we start in Psalm 15:1. O Lord, who may abide in your tent? Who may dwell on your holy hill? Now, of course, the tent there is the sanctuary, the tabernacle. In fact, the NIV has sanctuary in its translation. O Lord, who may abide in your tabernacle, in your tent? Now, what is that referring to? Well, that could refer to heaven, because a tent is where someone lives and God lives in heaven, but I don't think that's what it means because of the parallelism here. Who may abide in your tent? Who may dwell on your holy hill? So it's referring to the tent on the holy hill, because tent is in parallel with holy hill. And what tent was on Mount Zion, the holy hill? What tent was that? Well, that was the tabernacle. And that is where God lived. Now, when I say the tabernacle, it's probably the new tabernacle that David built to receive the ark. When David moved the ark from Kiriath-Jearim into Jerusalem, and he built a new place for that ark, the NIV Study Bible says the Hebrew word here is literally tent, which is the way the NASB translates it. And the NIV Study Bible says that means the tabernacle. Of course, it's not the temple, because the temple wasn't built until after David died under Solomon. Now, what is this tent, this tabernacle, symbolic of or typical of? Adam Clark says it's a type. The tabernacle is a type of the church on earth, the church militant, as opposed to the church in heaven, which is the church triumphant. If that's the case, then David would be saying, O Lord, who may abide amongst your people here on the earth? Now, Adam Clark here says that there is a difference between the church, and when we say church, let's say the Old Testament and New Testament people of God, the people of God, difference between the people of God and the kingdom of heaven. The church militant is represented by the tabernacle, because the tabernacle moved just like the people of God do in this world. It went from Shiloh, from Gilead to Shiloh, into the land of the Philistines, through several places before it ended up at Kiriath-Jearim. And Clark says this is a type of the people of God who move, who don't have any rest. There was no rest for the tabernacle until it stayed stationary on the holy hill, and the church militant has no rest either as it wanders, as it heads for its permanent home in heaven. As Clark says, the church is, quote, wandering up and down, tossed by various storms and tempest, the followers of God, having here no continuing city, sojourning only on earth to get a preparation for eternal glory. Clark says to contrast that with the holy hill, where the ark is finally settled. The holy hill, Zion, is a type of the kingdom of heaven, the church triumphant. The ark became stationary there. That's typical of the rest that remains for the people of God as we are stationary, as we are at peace and at rest in heaven. Well, that's a lot of highfalutin typology. I usually don't go in for that kind of stuff, but I thought it was kind of interesting. Since Clark mentioned it, I will too. It's really a rabbit trail. I think the easiest thing to do is to say that tent and holy hill are the same thing, and they can be conflated into one symbol, i.e. the kingdom of God. So David is saying here, at the least, who may abide in the kingdom of God? That's what he's saying. Whether the kingdom of God is on earth or in heaven, it doesn't make any difference. We don't need to get that particular with it. Now, David says, who may dwell on your holy hill? Of course, that's Zion. And we've talked about Zion many times in the first chapter of Psalms on the audio pertaining thereto. It's a symbol of where God lives with his people, the presence of God in the presence of his people. And holy hill means the same thing, and we'll see that in Psalms 2, verse 6. But as for me, I have installed my king upon Zion, my holy mountain. There, Zion and holy mountain are in apposition, showing that Zion is the holy mountain or the holy hill, depending on how you translate mountain. We look at Psalm 3, verse 4. I was crying to the Lord with my voice, and he answered me from his holy mountain. Psalms 43:3. Oh, send out your light and your truth. Let them lead me. Let them bring me to your holy hill and to your dwelling places. So the holy hill is where God dwells, his dwelling places. He lives on the holy hill. He's in the tabernacle, and we live there with him. We go now to Psalms 15, verses 2 through 4. David answers the question, who can live on the holy hill with God? Answer, verse 2, he who walks with integrity and works righteousness and speaks truth in his heart. He does not slander with his tongue, nor does evil to his neighbor, nor takes up a reproach against his friend, in whose eyes a reprobate is despised, but who honors those who fear the Lord. He swears to his own hurt and does not change. Sounds like a pretty righteous person that lives with God in God's tent on God's holy hill. In verse 2, the one who works righteousness is said to be able to live with God in his tent on God's holy hill. Well, now that works, the man who works righteousness, that cannot be taken in the New Testament Pauline sense, because then one could be saved by works righteousness. Oh, I work righteousness, now I get to live with God. Can't mean that, obviously. That would contradict about every basic tenet of theology that we know. Well, then what does it mean? Well, a couple of options. John Gill says it means the righteousness obtained from God by faith. So when David says that people who work righteousness can live with God, he just assumes it means people who have faith in God and then God helps them to be righteous. Here's how Gill puts it, quote, not in order to his justification before God, for not such an one, but he that trusts in the Lord for righteousness shall inherit his holy mountain. But he that works the work of faith and believes in the righteousness of Christ, who looks to it and receives it, that lays hold on it, the righteousness of Christ, and pleads it as his justifying righteousness. He that does righteousness in this sense is righteous as Christ is righteous. And such an one is a proper person to dwell in his house, and who also, by faith, does works of righteousness, and whose life is a series and course of righteousness as a fruit of his faith, and in consequence of his having laid hold on the righteousness of Christ. Well, that's a very prolix 19th century way of saying that the works that are done here are the fruit of one's faith and not at the root of one's faith. And those works that are the fruit of one's faith then qualify you to enter into God's house and live with him. Well, I think that's true, but it could be that David is using the word righteousness in the sense of a relative righteousness. For example, when Job kept saying, I'm righteous, he didn't mean he was sinlessly perfect like Adam and Eve were before the fall. He was just saying, I didn't do something really bad that would cause all this suffering. And so this is what David is talking about. He's talking about people who speak truth. They don't slander. They don't do evil to the neighbor. They don't reproach his friends. They despise reprobates. Well, you can think of non-believers who do that. You can think of atheists who do that. So David here is only speaking of a relative morality. This is my idea. I didn't see it in a commentary anywhere, but it makes sense that David is not talking about a perfect righteousness that would get one into heaven without God's grace. A man who walks with integrity and works righteousness and speaks truth and doesn't slander and doesn't do evil to his neighbor, he's still a sinner because somewhere he's going to sin. But that's not what David's talking about. This righteous man that David is talking about does have sin, but he does sorrow for his sin. He lapses into sin and loathes it, unlike the self-righteous person who leaps into sin and loves it. So basically, we have to keep from importing New Testament ideas of righteousness back into the Old Testament. David didn't understand all that. Now, in verse 4, David says, this man who walks with integrity, who can live with God in his tent on God's holy hill, despises the reprobate. Well, that sounds like it's a good thing to hate the sinner. Oh, I despise reprobates. I get to live with God. Well, I think that David's words are shorthand. What he really means is the man who wants to walk in integrity and live with God in God's tent on God's holy hill must hate the works of the reprobate, not the sinner himself. In other words, that old formula, hate the sin, love the sinner, applies. Now, in verse 4, at the end of the verse, this man of integrity who gets to live with God in God's tent swears to his own hurt. That's a sound basis for contract law. You know, you marry somebody, you sign a marriage contract, and all of a sudden you decide, I don't like this woman anymore. Too bad you signed the contract. Let me give you another example. Let's say that A promises to sell a product at a low price, and before the delivery of the product to B, the price of the raw materials skyrocket, such as is happening right now in America. Well, now, if A is a righteous person, he will deliver his goods to B at the low price because that's what he swore to do when he signed the contract. If you're in business, you're going to make contracts that don't turn out well. you better keep your word. In fact, if you don't keep your contract, you'll end up in court. But as a Christian, you better do it. You better keep your contract. You better swear to your own hurt. He swears to his own hurt and does not change. In other words, he doesn't change from the deal that he made. We go now to Psalms 15, verse 5, and we will finish up this psalm. This righteous man, the man of integrity, who wants to live with God in God's tent on God's holy mountain, he does not put out his money at interest, nor does he take a bribe against the innocent. He who does these things will never be shaken. So is this verse saying that a banker who puts his money out at interest, he lends money at interest, he's going to be shaken? He's not a man of integrity. He can never live with God in God's tent on God's holy hill. No, that's not what it means. Of course not. It's interesting. The NIV uses the old-fashioned word or the legal term for lending at interest. The NIV says this man of integrity lends his money without usury, which is the legal term of lending at interest. Now, we have to be really careful here because in the Old Testament, usury or lending at interest was done for people who were making loans to the poor. They were called charity loans. They had to be lent at zero interest, and the poor man who suffered a disaster or who had some kind of financial setback and couldn't live because he didn't have any money, somebody lends him money as a charity thing. The poor man then has to pay the principal back with no interest. So the lender is actually donating the interest to the person receiving the charity. Now, we don't have those today, so whenever we see this lending money as a sin, it ends up being confusing to us. And, of course, the Catholic Church is confused about it all during the Middle Ages, and it caused all kinds of grief and hindrance to the development of capitalism in Europe. Well, let's look at some scriptures that say that the Israelites are not supposed to lend their money at interest. Exodus 22:25. If you lend money to my people, to the poor among you, notice to the poor among you, you are not to act as a creditor to him. You shall not charge him interest. So lending money to the poor, it's a charity loan. Leviticus 25:36-37. Do not take usurious interest from him, but revere your God that your countryman may live with you. You shall not give him your silver at interest, nor your food for gain. Again, it's a charity loan. No interest. Deuteronomy 23, verse 19. You shall not charge interest to your countrymen, interest on money, food, or anything that may be loaned at interest. We see this idea in the New Testament also in Luke 6, verses 34-35. If you lend to those from whom you expect to receive, now let's change lend there to give. If you give to those from whom you expect to receive, in English we would say give, not lend. The NASB very literal says lend, as do all the other translations. But what it really means is if you give to those from whom you expect to receive, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners in order to receive back the same amount. But love your enemies and do good and lend, expecting nothing in return. Of course, a banker is not going to lend expecting nothing in return. This is talking about charity here, giving. In fact, as the NIV Study Bible points out, it may even refer to the giving of the principal as well as the interest. When you lend, expect nothing in return, does that mean expect not the interest in return or expect not even the principal? Now, we have to be careful here because there's absolutely nothing wrong with lending money at interest. No society can function without finance. And finance without interest is absolutely impossible. So the verses that prohibit interest are referring to charity loans, and that's how you solve the apparent problem that interest is a sin. Charity loan, the poor creditor was to pay the principal back, but he didn't have to pay the interest on the loan back. As the NIV Study Bible says, this command focused more on helping the poor than defining business ethics. Of course it did. Business loans for interest were perfectly okay. In fact, in the New Testament, Matthew 25:27, this is Jesus referring to the lazy slave in the parable of the talents. Then you ought to have put my money in the bank, and on my arrival, I would have received my money back with interest. Well, Jesus is referring to a normal business situation. He doesn't act like there's anything wrong with it. He encourages it. He encourages taking the money out of the ground, putting it in the bank, and getting it back with interest. If he's encouraging that, I would tend to think that Jesus doesn't see anything wrong with it. Back in the Old Testament, Deuteronomy 23:20, the law says this, you may charge interest to a foreigner, but to your countrymen you shall not charge interest. So there's nothing wrong with charging interest to foreigners. So that's the simple answer. But now other people have come up with a different answer as to how to explain the alleged sin of lending money. this view says that lending money is okay, but charging immoderate interest or excessive interest is condemned. But it's okay to charge a moderate amount of interest. John Gill takes this approach and he says this, to lend money on moderate interest, and according to the laws, customs, and usages of nations, and to take interest for it is no more unlawful than to take interest for houses and land. Yea, it is according to the law of common justice and equity that if one man lends money to another to trade with and gain by, that he should have a proportionate share in the gain of such a trade. But the design of this passage and the law on which it is founded is to forbid all exactions and oppressions of the poor and all avaricious practices, and to encourage liberality and beneficence. And such who are covetous and bite and oppress the poor are not fit for church communion. Well, the problem with Gill's solution, it's wrong to charge immoderate interest, is how do you define immoderate? How do you define moderate interest? Interest rates fluctuate all the time, due to factors that have nothing to do with the desire to oppress the poor. For example, inflation. If you got a 20% inflation rate and you charge 21%, well, you're charging 1% interest, and that's not immoderate. How about risk? Some governments have allowed 20% interest rates on consumer loans because consumer loans are very risky, and so therefore 20% is considered non-usurious, non-excessive, because the risk of repayment is so great. So I think Gill's option is not going to fly. It has nothing to do with how much you charge interest for. It has to do with what kind of loan the loan is for. Is it a charity loan? Well, then you don't charge interest. If it's a business loan, you charge what the market will bear. This man who gets to live with God in God's tent on God's holy mountain does not take bribes against the innocent. That sounds like a judge. He's got to decide a case. The guilty party pays off the judge and says, make the innocent pay, not me. Ooh, that's a no-no. That's really bad. Exodus 23:8, you shall not take a bribe, for a bribe blinds the clear-sighted and subverts the cause of the just. Deuteronomy 16:19, you shall not distort justice, you shall not be partial, and you shall not take a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and perverts the wise of the righteous. So he who doesn't charge poor people money on charity loans, and he who does not take a bribe, if you do those things, David says at the end of verse 5, you will never be shaken. So ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Psalm chapter 15. That prepares us for our next audio, which will cover Psalms 16 verses 1 through 11, which we will entitle, You Will Not Abandon My Son. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.